Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
This Labor Day, labor organizers in the U.S. are celebrating some wins. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, September 5th. Good to have you along. Some labor news this Labor Day to start us off. In California today, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom signed the FAST Act, which sets up a wage council for fast food restaurants. What's new about this council is that it will have an equal split between those representing fast food companies and fast food workers, plus two government officials. The 10-member council will set wages and working conditions for more than 500,000 workers in the state. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
The idea of setting wages for an entire industry is rare in the U.S., but it's not exactly a new idea, says Kate Andreas, a professor at Columbia Law School.
All other industrial democracies have some system of either industrial bargaining or industrial standard setting. We are really an outlier.
Unionizing fast food workers the traditional way has been difficult in the U.S. Workers are spread over many small franchises, have high turnover, and face steep opposition from big corporations. So Ruth Milkman, a labor sociologist at CUNY, says the labor movement has changed its approach.
Instead of unionization, the vehicle is legislation.
Fast food employers are, unsurprisingly, not big fans.
You increase labor costs, by definition, that has to get passed through to consumers.
Economist Chris Thornburg of the UC Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development modeled how wage increases could affect consumer prices for the International Franchise Association. He found wage increases of 20% could add about $100 a year to food costs for the lowest income households.
You've got one group is going to benefit and the other group is going to be hurt.
The bill will cap wages at $22 an hour next year, about 40% above the minimum wage. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We learned last week that in August, the unemployment rate ticked up to 3.7%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And it turns out last month, people came off the sidelines to attempt to return to the labor force, so now they count as unemployed. The BLS also announced that its next report will mark the end of an era. September will be the last month the agency will ask supplemental questions about COVID-19 and the impact the pandemic has had on the labor market. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
The BLS has been asking people whether COVID affected how much they're working or prevented them from looking for work. Rachel Krantz-Kent is an economist with the BLS. She says the Bureau started asking those questions in May of 2020.
Businesses were closing. People were being told to stay at home, to socially distance. And so we really were interested in measuring, you know, the impact of those measures on the labor force.
Now, Krantz-Kent says those questions are getting outdated. So the BLS will start asking some new ones, and they'll focus on telework. How many people work from home at all? For how many hours? Megan Green, chief economist at the Kroll Institute, says the BLS is trying to wrap its head around some fundamental changes to the job market.
You know, my job, for example, is largely remote, and that never would have been a possibility before the pandemic.
The data will also let economists understand how telework affects different occupations and demographic groups. Misty Hagenes, a professor at the University of Kansas, has been researching the pressures mothers face while working from home. With this new data, she says,
we'll be able to know, did this person actually telework, yes or no? And then what do we see in trends for those people who are teleworking compared to those who weren't, both in terms of mom's ability to stay attached to the labor market, you know, women's labor market participation, et cetera.
The BLS will start asking the new questions in October. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed on this Labor Day holiday, so we'll take a look at European markets when we do the numbers. data from the Education Department shows that since the pandemic began, reading and math scores for fourth grade students dropped to the worst they've been in decades. Which brings me to this next piece on the importance of one of those two topics, reading. Educational technology company Byju's has a new product out called Osmo. It uses an iPad and an AI speech recognition program to help improve reading skills in young children. The company recruited some serious star power for the launch. LeVar Burton is the chief reading officer for Osmo. And I asked him about the challenges facing kids today when it comes to learning to read in this digital world.
There are indeed challenges unique to being a child who's learning how to read in this now moment. The amount of distractions that are available that can pull a child off the journey towards literacy are legion. So it's a very active, oftentimes confusing, sort of cacophonous world that children are having to focus and learn these rudiments of reading in, and anything we can do to help them focus, take advantage of their natural skills and inclinations and curiosities in the service of learning to read, I'm in.
Does it matter, though, where and how a child reads? I was talking to a school teacher on a plane, and she said that, you know, she had some concerns about children only reading on these small screens as opposed to on a broader space. Does it really make a difference if a kid is reading on a tablet versus on a phone versus a physical book?
That's a really complex question, Kimberly, because there is the issue of how much screen time is appropriate for a child. Having said that, I simply want kids to read, okay? And parents ask me all the time, how do I get my child to read more? And I ask them generally two questions. One, do your children see you reading? Because it is that all-important example, that modeling, that really informs a child just how important the activity of reading is to you as their parent. The second question I ask them is, what is your child passionate about? Because it's our passions that really drive our reading appetite. So if your kid loves superheroes, then damn it, buy your kid comic books. And if their only access to literature is via a device, then that's what we use.
I was obsessed with books as a kid. I mean, I'd go through dozens in a summer, but you know, I had my 12-year-old niece and my 10-year-old nephew down for visits this summer, and I'm like throwing books at them, trying to find their interest. And they're just not so much into reading. They'd rather watch reels or social media clips. Yeah. And I just wonder how you can get kids to get into longer stories. And I just want them to love the written word like I do.
If you need to use the engagement factor of technology, which I recognize in this world, we do, because it's something that they're familiar with. Again, in the 80s, America's kids were sitting in front of the television set. That's why we went to TV. But today's kid, they are digital natives, Kimberly, and we have to use that to our advantage. That has to be our entry point, because the purpose has always been meet them where they are.
I'm sure that you hear this all the time, but I did grow up watching Reading Rainbow. And when I told my sister that I was going to talk to you, she literally burst out in the song. Full, the whole thing, beginning to end. But, you know, she was thinking out loud about someone like you who spent so many decades around children's literacy, and especially being a Black man in this space, how you feel about what you see as the impact, and are you seeing it the way that you want to?
Well, every day of my life, I encounter someone like you and your sister who grew up on the show and report to me that it had a powerful, positive impact on their life. A couple of generations ago, it would have been illegal for me to have the gift of literacy, right? Punishable by whipping, certainly, death, perhaps. To have grown up the son of an English teacher, a Black man, to become a symbol for literacy in this country. I can't even begin to share with you the depth of pride that brings me and my family.
Thank you so very much. LeVar Burton is an actor, director, producer, and now the chief reading officer for Baiju's Osmo. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Kimberly.
We've been talking a lot about jobs today, the way the ongoing pandemic is still affecting the labor market, and what new rules mean for fast food workers. Let's stick with that food theme a bit longer. Between 2017 and 2020, the number of culinary programs in the country dropped by 20%. And in the last two decades, enrollment in culinary schools fell to a fraction of what it used to be. In today's installment of our series, My Economy, we hear from someone who joined the growing band of people who set out to work with food without any formal training.
Hello, everyone. Philip Ashley Ricks here in Memphis, Tennessee, founder, CEO, and master chocolatier of Philip Ashley Chocolates, luxury designer chocolate company. When I first started in chocolate, I was currently in the supply chain logistics and consumer packaged goods industry. But for the past several years, you know, I'd really gotten bitten by the culinary bug. You know, Food Network was hot and heavy and all the cooking shows and things. And then I got to the point in 2012, I was starting to transition into a new job. And I just was like, well, I'd like to give it a go. So I looked into culinary school. That was a very brief exploration because chocolate wasn't something you really found in a traditional setting. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to just have to figure this out on my own. And that's what I set off to do. The startup costs weren't incredibly significant or staggering, but, you know, chocolate is expensive. It's expensive today. It was expensive then. Leasing a facility, getting equipment, starting a website. I think it took about $60,000, which isn't a small amount of money, I know. But I started doing pop-ups, doing events, doing tastings, and really just kind of testing the waters. Okay, do people like it? Do they like it enough to come back for more? All right, and then do they like it so much that they will actually pay for it? And so that was really kind of my measuring tool. Like, can I sell this? You know, will this make money? Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory has been a big inspiration. The thing that has always stood out to me was that stick of gum, you know, the stick of gum that had the tomato soup, that had the roast beef, the potatoes. You know, when I was researching other chocolate companies, researching the industry, I was really looking for less of what was being done and more of what was not being done. And that's really where I came to the conclusion that, okay, I need to be doing things like putting blue cheese in chocolate, barbecue chocolate, because I lived in Memphis. Like, okay, yeah, let's do some stuff that's inspired by where I'm from. I was just coming up with things, you know, apricot and gorgonzola dolce and dates and red wine and all these kind of things blended into chocolate. That's why we keep making chocolates. It's like every chocolate should tell a story. So a lot of chocolate to make.
Well, now I want chocolate. That was Philip Ashley Ricks, a chocolatier in Memphis, Tennessee. We can't do this series without you, so please share your stories and chocolates if you have them at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up...
And if they peck at you, just... don't peck back.
A helpful lesson in chicken farming. But first, let's do the numbers. Capital markets in the U.S. were closed today to mark the Labor Day holiday. But in Europe, France's CAC 40 fell 1 2/10%. Germany's DAX gave up 2 2/10%. Britain's FTSE added just shy of 0.1% on the day we learned that the UK will have a new prime minister come tomorrow, Conservative Liz Truss. And she inherits a British economy that's not doing so well, with an inflation rate over 10% and rising, according to the Office for National Statistics in London. Energy prices have basically doubled since spring and are set to triple by winter. The new PM is reportedly considering a freeze on household energy bills to address the crisis. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. You don't have to look very hard to see the impact of global warming. Droughts, floods, record high temperatures, and it's already having an impact on global commerce. In Panama, global warming and changing weather patterns are affecting the water supply used to operate the Panama Canal. That connection between the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans is immensely important to the Panamanian economy. But continuing to divert water from other parts of the country to sustain it is controversial. The BBC's Grace Livingstone reports.
This is the sound of an enormous ship making its way through the Panama Canal. Upon its completion in 1914, this man-made waterway linking the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans nearly halved the travel time between the United States West Coast and Europe, revolutionising trade and travel in the Western Hemisphere. 15,000 ships still go through the canal each year, but climate change is threatening this vital trade route and also the supply of fresh water to millions of Panamanians.
Hi. Hello.
Steve Patton is a scientist at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama City, which works closely with the Panama Canal authorities monitoring changes in the climate.
One of the things that Panama has through the Panama Canal Authority is a time series of rainfall that goes back to 1880. And what we've seen in the area of the Panama Canal in the last 22, 24 years, we've had 8 of the 10 greatest storms, the 2 driest years, and the single driest 3 years in a row. So we've set all kinds of records.
The canal links the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. Between the oceans in Panama are mountains, on top of which are huge artificial lakes. Water is released from these lakes down to the locks in order to raise the ships. On average, 37 ships go through the locks each day, using more than 2 billion gallons of water a day. But the canal also provides drinking water to more than half of the country. Environmental lawyer Rodrigo Noriega told me that the canal's dual function creates even greater pressure on water resources.
The water of the canal is also the source of fresh water for the Panama City. So as Panama City grows, there is less water for the canal. So the canal is under a lot of stress to find new sources of water.
The canal authorities are carrying out feasibility studies on a number of options, including deepening existing artificial lakes to capture more rainwater or desalinating seawater. One possibility being studied by the canal authorities is building a dam on the River Indio, which could displace thousands of small farmers. This is Coclé province in central Panama. A group of small farmers have walked 3 hours along muddy roads to meet me. Diego Herrera farms a plot of land in Coquillo.
All of us who live in this region depend on the land. What will we do if they flood our land? Where will we go? We are against this because they haven't explained to us where they will relocate us.
It's important to emphasize that the dam is only one of many possible options under consideration. And the canal authorities stress that they'll opt for the solution that has the lowest environmental and social impact. But as global warming changes weather patterns, this marvel of 20th century engineering will have to find ways to adapt to the 21st century. Global shipping and the Panamanian people are both depending on that. I'm the BBC's Grace Livingstone for Marketplace.
Labor Day marks the unofficial end of summer, and the start of autumn means, yes, sweater weather, but also in many places, trips to the pumpkin patch, apple picking, corn mazes. The business term for all those fun fall activities is agricultural tourism, and it's a rapidly growing industry. Now, some farmers are offering tourists a more intimate experience, where you can sleep and, if you're down for it, even work on the farm. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker reports.
Outside the little town of Renshaw, Minnesota, on the locally laid egg farm, it's 5:45 a.m. Most people on vacation would still be snoozing, but not Clay Yeager and his 9-year-old son Isaac. For them, it's time to let out the chickens.
Good morning!
For about $50 a night, the Yeagers can sleep in a small outbuilding in the chicken yard. It's two-thirds bunkhouse, one-third chicken coop, separated only by a couple panes of glass.
These are our roommates for the night.
They can actually see the chickens while they're sleeping, and vice versa. It's kind of a peep show, says Isaac Yeager.
It's weird having chickens stare at you, but if you get used to it, it's not much different.
Lucy and Jason Amundsen started their pasture-raised egg business 10 years ago. They raise 400 chickens themselves. They call this venture an Airbnb. The idea came from an article Lucy Amundsen read about a local business in Scotland where you can volunteer as part of your short-term vacation rental.
It is an apartment above a bookstore, and you run the bookstore. And I turned to Jason, and I said, we could do this.
Along with the bunkhouse, the Amundsens also built what they call the Perch, a tiny house on stilts in a patch of woods. They estimate they'll earn about $13,000 this year renting both out. Lucy Amundsen says that would add nearly 20% to the farm's annual profit.
That's real money for a farmer. And there is kind of a sad commentary there that raising food with integrity isn't quite enough anymore.
And Jason Amundsen says costs are up these days, everything from wages to egg cartons.
It's just endless expenses, right? So this is a nice way to cover that overhead.
There's also another benefit to having vacationers on hand. They can help with farm chores. At 8:30 a.m., guests can help gather eggs from the coops. Jason Amundsen gives instruction.
Put your palm down underneath the bird and then lift the bird up. Yep, that's the way to go about it. And if they peck at you, just don't peck back.
Clay Yeager and his son feed the hens and fill containers with water for them to drink.
Take the water right there, lift it up and dump it.
They even help scrape out chicken poop from a coop. Yeager says he's always wanted to take his son to a farm.
It's a good experience for him to see where food actually comes from.
As the number of Americans who work on farms has dwindled, the number of people seeking out ways to experience agriculture has surged. Dawn Thilmany is a professor at Colorado State University who researches agritourism. She grew up on a farm in Iowa. Personally, Thilmany couldn't wait to escape to the big city.
But to anyone who didn't get that or didn't have a grandfather or grandmother still on the farm who didn't get to do that, they just wanted a touch of Americana. And to a lot of people, that's a big dose of Americana.
The USDA estimates that agritourism, everything from corn mazes to farm-grown dinners to dude ranches, has grown to nearly a $1 billion industry. For Jason and Lucy Amundsen, it's also a reminder of why they farm.
Oftentimes we'll be falling asleep and we just hear laughter on the fields. Mm. And I did not expect that much joy from this. Yeah. I just thought like, oh, this will be fun.
She says the short-term rentals have helped their business, but it's also been surprisingly fun. In Renshaw, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This quick final note on the way out today, sticking with our Labor Day theme. If you feel like you've been hearing more about labor unions lately, it's not your imagination. A Bloomberg Law analysis of data from the National Labor Relations Board found unions are having their best year since 2005, winning 641 workplace elections in the first half of 2022. 200 of those wins were at Starbucks. And one last labor-related data point for your moment of economic context. Polling by Gallup shows support for labor unions at its highest rate since 1965, with 71% of Americans approving of unions. That's up from 64% before the pandemic. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.